welcome the Secretariat for Safety and Security, the Department of Home Affairs, that I think they've just arrived. I can see the police is also represented here, the Office of the Minister, as well as our support staff. You are all welcome to this meeting, media, if you are here. We have two items on our agenda. The first one will be the briefing by the Secretariat on the declaration of an amnesty in terms of the Firearms Control Act, and that will be done by the Secretariat. Following that, we will then have to move on to adopting the report, if we have to do it. In fact, I think we have to. Then that will be followed by the briefing by the Department of Home Affairs on our bill that is before us. Let me again inform the meeting and ask for your sincere indulgence and your apology. I will have to request Honorable Schneeman, not because he has just arrived, to chair the meeting between 10:30 and 12. As I indicated, I'm from the Deputy Speaker's meeting, and out there is some work or meeting that I have to attend between that. And I will request that he chairs the meeting, and I will come back immediately at 12 when that meeting attends. And this is the apology I'm extending to the meeting. It is definitely not because I think that meeting is important, but because there are visitors from another country and they need briefing on some of the things that we are doing, even as members of the committee. And my apologies for that. I will therefore not waste time. I will request the Secretariat to take us through the report, and then we'll move on from there. Over to you, Mr.
Thanks. Chairperson, thanks for the opportunity to speak to you about this. I think that the notice was sent to the Speaker and referred to the Chairperson. So people should have a copy of the notice. If they haven't, I have got some copies here of the notice. But in terms of the Firearms Control Act, Section 1391 of the Firearms Control Act allows the Minister to declare an amnesty if it is possible that amnesty will result in a reduction of weapons and if that amnesty is in the public interest. However, such a notice declaring an amnesty is only valid if it's approved by Parliament and if there are two other aspects to it. The first is that it is period specific, so that the amnesty is very clear on what period the amnesty is for and if there are very clear conditions surrounding the amnesty. The intention of the Minister is to declare an amnesty from the 11th of January 2010 to the 11th of April 2010, so it would be essentially a three-month amnesty. The focus of the amnesty is on people who have knowledge of the whereabouts of firearms and ammunition, people who inherited firearms but who didn't apply for licenses under the Firearms Control Act, weapons that were sold legally, but where a person may still be in possession of some of the features of that weapon, such as sights, etc. Manufacturers and dealers and gunsmiths who have excess or redundant stocks of weapons. People who currently have weapons, but whose storage facilities are illegal. And private security people who would have surplus or redundant weapons and wish to get rid of those weapons. I think the amnesty process itself If one looks at the amnesty that occurred in 2005, one can see the success of such an amnesty process. During that amnesty in 2005, more than 33,000 illegal weapons were handed in, 46,000 legal weapons, and during the same period, 17,000 weapons were seized, more than 17,000 weapons were seized. So just during that process in 2005, more than 98,000 weapons were actually recovered as a result both of the amnesty and the seizures that had taken place. In terms of the provisions of the amnesty, no explosives or explosive devices are able to be handed in. It allows for an anonymous hand-in of illegal weapons. People are also going to be able to, under this amnesty, apply for licenses. People who miss the cut-off date for applying for licenses will be able to apply for licenses as long as they meet the criteria stipulated in the Firearms Control Act. And I think that's quite important, because one of the things that we would like to see is that we don't use the Firearms Control Act to criminalize people, so that people will be able to, under this amnesty, apply for licenses if they miss the cut-off date. As I said, as long as they are compliant, as long as they follow all the provisions set out in the Firearms Control Act. They will not be able to apply for licenses anonymously, obviously. That if they apply for licenses, they will have to give all their details. If a licensed firearm is handed in, that will also not be able to be an anonymous process, because people will have to be, that license will have to be revoked. There will be no compensation for licenses handed in. There is a separate compensation process which is about to be finalized. And people will not be able to get amnesty for crimes committed with the firearms. In terms of the process, people would surrender their firearms at the local police station, and the local police station would log those firearms, and the person handling the firearms would receive a number as a receipt of the firearms that were handed in. All the weapons that are handed in during this period will have to be destroyed within 6 months of the amnesty. The approach that we would like to adopt is a similar approach to what was adopted in the 2005 amnesty process, which is a three-pronged approach. The one is the voluntary surrender of licensed firearms, so where people no longer want to possess their firearms and have licenses, they would be able to make use of this process. The surrender of illegal firearms through an anonymous process, and then that will be accompanied with visible policing operations to actually try and recover weapons from people who do not want to make use of this amnesty process and who would have illegal firearms. I'm going to ask Director Fortner if he has anything to add to that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think maybe members will want to ask a few questions, if there are any. Honorable Konapanat, Honorable George.
Thank you. I just wondered if we had any idea of how many firearms which were legal have been rendered illegal by the death of the owner, and now leave the person who's inherited the firearm with the task of having it licensed. This was previously quite a difficult procedure. I see it's allowed for here in this, which might ease the situation. But I wondered if we had any idea of numbers, because the firearms legislation has been something of a failure, in that people have waited literally years to receive a license. Now I'm wondering if what you're saying here is the actual licensing of the firearms, is that going to land us with the same sort of administrative difficulties? I mean, we even have the SAP law advisor who's been waiting, I think he told me, 3 years for his license. So it's not an administrative success as such. So I'm just wondering, are we ready to cope with the additional administrative burden?
Madam Chair, my question is one and a simple one. seeing that this is not the first declaration of amnesty, if the Secretary could just briefly tell us whether the previous amnesties have been a success or what, or did they have any impact in terms of reducing the number of firearms in the country?
I think those are the two questions.
Can I just respond to the second question first? I think that at the beginning, what happened during the amnesty in 2005 was that without, if you exclude the amount of weapons seized during operations, which was 17,000, more than 46,000 legal firearms were handed in during that amnesty process, and more than 33,000 illegal firearms. To me, that is a significant number of firearms to take out of circulation. And I'm going to ask Director Bortman to respond to the number of weapons that have been inherited that have become. But I think in terms of the administrative process, I think he can also make some comments on that. But one of the things that we are going to be doing parallel with this process is to just look at a review of what the administrative blockages are and how we can actually deal with those blockages, because we're aware that some of the blockages may be from our side that we need to deal with that. But some of the blockages, certainly in some of the cases that we've dealt with, are also because people have not necessarily understood all the procedures. So one of the things we are going to be looking at doing parallel with this process, and that the Minister is very keen on, is to look at a review of the blockages so that we can find ways of dealing with those blockages. But I'll also ask the Director to respond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Honourable members, it's a privilege once again to do a presentation. I think, just to clear it first of all, in respect of the inherited firearms, if you talk about figures, in our system we talk about more than 200,000 people that is dead today, that stole today's firearms. The problem that we currently encounter in South Africa, it is in respect of the reporting of these firearms that you inherited. It is a lengthy, tedious process, and I agree it takes time, it's an administrative burden. It is therefore we call on this amnesty, and specifically the people that inherited the firearms. Madam Chair, and honestly speaking, there's quite frankly a number of people that inherited firearms quite a time ago. And I literally mean in the 90s, but up to now they never reported to the registrar. Now we want once and for all to open a door for all that people to come to the fore during this amnesty, because currently they're sitting with the firearms. They did not comply with the Act in terms of Regulation 103 to report to the register. So we want to take this opportunity with a very simple process that the person can walk to the police station in terms of handing in the firearms, in terms of the occurrence book, as well as we complete the interview setting, we will place it on the system, and at least we can get control of the firearms that currently is in circulation that people inherited, but they never apply for firearm licenses. Madam Chair, I think it's important that we must take note in terms of the legislation. The legislation is very clear. If a person selects still after this period of time to apply for a firearm license, he or she may still do so. But these people need to provide us with the necessary detail, as what the Secretariat already indicated, because we need to run the administrative process with that specific individual. They need to comply with the provisions of the Act. So it's not an amnesty in terms of the Act. You still need to comply if you want to apply. People that do not want to apply for firearm licenses. And what happened, Madam Chair, I was privileged to also was operation head in the previous amnesty. In our debriefing sessions, it was very clear that our high-profile criminals at that stage did not hand in their firearms, meaning they, in the previous amnesty, we forced them to provide all their details, and they were scared to provide their details. This time we want to move away. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Honourable Annelies. Chairperson, the Paul Kaku, will follow.
Obviously, we have all asked for the certain amnesty period for two reasons. I think the one is that it's proven in the past that we get rid of firearms that are in circulation, whether they are legal or illegal. And that even those legal firearms that are no longer wanted, we get out of the system so that they cannot become illegal firearms. However, the comment that Director Bortman just made raised some concerns with me, the one about the ability for people to come and anonymously hand in firearms. and he specifically referred to high-profile criminals. My concern is what then stopped me from committing crimes during that period and then just simply come and hand in that weapon anonymously. That to me is a bit of a...
Exactly, Jefferson. To follow up, thank you, Jefferson. To follow up to that question, because it seems as if there will be a problem, there will be a blockage. One side and the other side can kill somebody today and then hand it over tomorrow. And hand it over tomorrow. So, it seems as if there, you can't have it both sides. There's something wrong with this amnesty. If you say that, you see, you can't have the blockages of the people who are applying for licenses on the other side. On the other side, you are declaring an amnesty. And then you are saying that anybody can hand in any time, without it, anonymously. And then thereafter, no records will be kept and so on. What will happen is an ambush of a high-profile person, and then tomorrow, the gun is handed over. What will happen to that?
Okay, over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I must just clear it. First off, all the amnesty is only on the illegal possession of the firearms. All firearms that are handed in currently in South Africa that come into the certain stores are subject to either station. So these firearms will be either station. So if you commit a murder, you do not get amnesty on the murder, only for the illegal possession of the firearms. And that is what is the amnesty about.
Can I just make a comment on that? I think that people are going to have to go into their police station to hand those firearms in. I think that we're looking at the anonymous aspect of it. It's not to actually deal with the criminals, because the comment made about high-profile criminals, I think those criminals, the ability is for SACs to actually, when a firearm is handed in, if there is a particular suspicion around that person, is to actually refuse that firearm and take and follow the necessary procedures in terms of the either state.
We seem not to be getting clarity.
No.
As to how you're going to deal with the situation where crime is committed with the use of a firearm, and the firearm is handed over to the police station the following day. You seem not to be getting clarity on that one, because I think that is important. And surely there will be a relationship between the firearm used and the crime committed. You can't separate the two. You surely need the firearm that you have used. So we just want to be sure about that. That people are not going to kill people, run to the police station, hand over the gun or firearms and that's it.
Can I ask
Let me take hands. Ms. Chafer, Ms. Kola Barnard, Honorable Mullick George, Honorable Sleman.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I also how is we going to decide this person looks like a criminal? I mean, there's no way you can just assess it by looking at somebody. I mean, that doesn't comfort me at all. And I mean, I think we need to face the reality, really, that people who are really the problem, the criminals, are not going to come and hand in their firearms. That's for sure. But I mean, there's no clarity at all on this issue of who's a criminal and how you're going to decide.
Absolutely, Chair. I would like steps. I think let's just try and stop this where it and get some clarity from them. Has there ever in the history of the SAP been an instance when a criminal has shot someone and gone and handed a gun into a police station? I mean, for heaven's sake, surely they'll just bury it or throw it in the ocean if they want to distance themselves from it. It's actually quite a bizarre question. I don't know if they could just tell us if ever such an incident has ever occurred, because I actually don't think there's such a problem. I think we're actually creating it right now.
My question, Madam Chair, is just simple, because probably we need some more explanation from them. How does this process of anonymous work? How do these people who are going to head over this anonymous, how is it going to work? Because I think that's where the problem is. If we can get, probably we don't understand, if they can tell us how this thing of anonymity is going to work when they submit this file.
Chair, I think I've basically been covered. My question was really going to be around the how is somebody going to suspect somebody that walks in. That's it. In fact, I find that a very weak argument or a very weak case to accept. So I think it needs to be rethought that. Thanks, Chair.
Like I said, Chairperson, it would be a pity if we can't agree on this because of that aspect of the amnesty. Because clearly there is a need for amnesty. I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that it's an excellent idea to provide amnesty also for those people who have missed the deadline so that they are not criminalized, either to hand in their weapons or to then apply for licenses. But I seriously have a problem with this anonymous issue. It doesn't make sense to me. The answers we've been receiving up to now is not clarifying the issue. Look, with all due respect, all firearms that are going to be added in are going to be either seized, am I right? But why would you rid yourself of the opportunity to follow the trace from that person that has handed in the firearm if it's seen that a crime has been committed with that firearm after the either seizing? Why on earth would we then not deny ourselves to couple that firearm with an individual? I don't understand that part of it.
Chairperson, if people want to hand in firearms, know that they will not be prosecuted. My question is, why should it be done anonymously? Because they know they will not be prosecuted. Now, there are advantages of knowing where the firearm comes from. And I would propose that when the firearms are handed in, the police must want to know where they got them and how they got them, while they assure the person lends it in that they will not be prosecuted. But just to say anybody can just have it there, I don't think it's solving a problem. And I also want to know whether firearms that are handed over by children, for example, if a person is a criminal and then use the firearms to commit a crime, they can easily give it to a boy to hand it in. If such a case does happen, would they want to find out from the boy where they got it from, or how do they handle the situation?
I can respond to the question.
Sorry, when I talked about profiling, I wasn't talking about people walk in and they get profiled, but all police stations have lists of wanted suspects. So obviously if those suspects enter the police station in terms of the firearms, that has to be dealt with. I think that Honourable Kola Barnard has raised the point that we haven't had a situation before where people have ever come in and handed in those firearms. I think also the point that was raised is that if you want to do it anonymously, you can actually get somebody else to hand in the firearm for you anyway. If that's what your intention is, even if we do take details, you can get somebody else to hand it in on your behalf. But we don't necessarily have a problem with taking out the anonymous, if that is a major concern to people. But we would have a problem going into details, because I think if we go into details, we're going to discourage people, that we're going to start losing people's trust in terms of the amnesty itself.
Questions have also been read out of anonymity, but also it's not the first time that we have amnesty. Can you probably brief us on your previous experience and how you handled some of these questions that are arising?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Can I just take issue with what the Secretary said? I agree with that the person can ask Greg to go and hand in the weapon, and I've just committed a crime with it. But then the police have got a trace by talking to Greg and asking me who gave you this weapon. Because if you are saying that you didn't commit a crime, who gave you this weapon to hand in? And we don't understand, I think that's the problem, why you would not want to do away with that trace.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the previous amnesty, people, when they surrender the firearm, they need to complete the form. We call it the 522A and the 522B, where they forfeit this firearm now to the state, and then they said that they will not put any claim against the state. So it was a process that they go to the police station. They still need to go to the police station, and they did go to the police station, but they need to complete a lot of documentation. And that is where we say the administrative process comes in, and where we try to fast track this process by saying to a person, come to the police station, hand in a firearm, we make an entry in our firearms book about the firearm, because the purpose of the amnesty, Madam Chair, is to get illegal firearms. That is the main purpose of it. And then secondly, so that was the intention, but I think we will not have a problem because we already threw the whole trial around in the previous amnesty to follow the same procedure there. Just limit our administrative burden in this respect. Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Harden, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what is important and what should be considered by the committee is the question whether we want to remove illegal firearms from the street. If we go through a process, like in the past, where people have to provide full identification in particular to the police, then there is a large number, as we experience in Brazil, of people who will not be willing to come to the police station and hand in the firearms. So if the purpose is to get firearms off the street, then anonymity is important, because then people will not fear that they will be prosecuted. So that is the purpose of this proposed amnesty. The previous one was different, because a person had to provide full particulars and the police can follow it up. And although we had received quite a large number of firearms, we believe that there are lots of firearms out there still who are illegal and that people did not hand in. And we believe that a large number of those people did not hand it in for the simple reason because they had to provide particulars. Remember, the amnesty relates to the illegal possession of the firearm and not to any crime that was committed with it. So therefore, if the police during its investigation determined that this firearm was used in the commission of a crime, then the police will follow normal investigative procedures in order to determine who that person was. Thank you.
Can I just say that we've got no problem, and I stated at the beginning, with taking out the anonymity aspect of it. The concerns raised here need to be heard and taken on board, and we have no problem with taking out that aspect of the declaration. Because I don't think it's fundamental to what we're trying to do. If you look at who the amnesty is focused on, I don't think that fundamentally we will be altering the intention of the amnesty by taking out the anonymity clause.
I'm taking the very last round of him. Honorable Nogonyan, I'm taking those who have not spoken. Honorable Annelies, Honorable Chifa, Honorable Reverend Misho, Honorable Zawu, in that order, Honorable Lichit.
Chair, Honorable Members, Secretary, good morning. Well, as I understand the notice, Chair, I hear what the response from the Secretariat. It visualizes two aspects involving this question of amnesty. The one is when you surrender the license, the firearm, and it is, you don't have a license, and therefore you are an illegal possessor. And I think paragraph A is very clear that no details are taken. In other words, it has been anonymous. To me, it's fundamental. And then the other one, B, is when, yes, it has been you didn't have any license to possess it, but you want, therefore, to follow legal processes to acquire lawfully. And clearly, I think the intention, as I understand, is that if I had them clearly, all those people must try and recuse quantity or the number of illegal firearms out there. How can we do it? People are not going to come, if I understand the intent, unless they are actually encouraged to come. And it comes not giving their details and then submit it. That's how I understand it. That is why I hear, but I think on this question of not of them not, I mean, treating this question of anonymity, it may defeat that purpose in paragraph 8, in my view. And my question would be then, Chair, is that if the firearms are handed in, let's say, no details from the person, is there no way that if then a crime has been committed, police can detect that through fingerprints and things like that later on? Or what was the position? Because I think that it may clarify some aspects and be able to lay our fears that, of course, those who committed crime yesterday may and those are today. And I quite agree with my colleagues that it is highly unlikely, practically speaking.
Jefferson, the question of whether we understand one and the same directive, doesn't it? The issue that the person that are going there are only getting amnesty for the possession of that file. We understand that. One and the same. There's no doubt in our minds about that. What we don't understand, and what your explanation, with all due respect, didn't clarify either, is how are you going to couple that firearm with the individual who's handed it in if there is anonymity? That is not clarifying, and that is our question in our mind. And with all due respect, with the number of undetected cases as reported by SAPS management less than 2 weeks ago to this very committee, I'm afraid you've got to also appreciate our cynicism around this issue.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Similarly, I agree. I mean, the amnesty will provide the reassurance to people who are giving their names that they will not be prosecuted. That's the whole point of the amnesty. So there's no reason to not give your name. And I agree with Honourable from Bain. Thank you.
Yeah, Chair, I think, and I believe that the head of the secretary did say they were prepared to take the anonymity clause out. I mean, if we look at the numbers of SAT firearms loss, we're talking about 7,000 odd in the last 3 years. Now, if someone has somehow got hold of one of those firearms and it's been previously used by some criminal, now hands it in, it should be easy to identify and we can track back. But then again, if that clause says, we're on a hiding to nowhere. We'll never track it back. We'll never know where it's been since the SAT member lost it. And I absolutely, that clause must go.
I'm having a problem, Chairperson. My problem is that I've sent Greg to hand over my car. I'm making it practical. I've just killed somebody yesterday. Yes, I'm very good at sending people. And I'm sending Craig tomorrow to hand over the car to the police station. Yes, in Melbourne. But I've killed somebody yesterday, or 5 people. Now, the first thing that will happen is that the firearm that is registered by Craig, the fingerprinting will be paid. Now, at the end of the day, Craig can't say he got it from me, because we have got an agreement with him or something about it. And he knows that by doing so, he may get something else. Now, how are we, you see, the anonymity is a problem. We want to get it clear. How are you going to, at the end of the day, really trace it? You see, if we want to say people who have been laid in apply for licenses, we don't want to criminalize them. We understand. But when it comes to the other section of criminals, then I don't understand.
Chairperson, when the question was asked whether the 2005 amnesty period was successful or not, the answer was it was. It was successful. And that time people were giving information. They were feeling informed. From what I hear, the problem is the cumbersome forms, the many forms that people are filling. So I would propose that there should be minimum information taken. But I think it's important that one knows where the firearm comes from. So if the compass of the forms that are being filled is reduced maybe to one or two pages, and then it is known where the firearm comes from, the person handing in the firearm might even tell how the firearm came into the country, which is information that the police require. Now, to say people, when a person is suspicious, I think we are innocent people will be harmed when a person is suspected. Actually, maybe they need to tell us how that a suspicious person look like. How does a suspicious person look like? So I think it is going to be problematic to say if a person is suspicious, then more information is going to be required for that person. I think that the process must be fair to everybody. If nobody is going to be told you're going to be suspected, then nobody must be suspected. I think the key that would help would be to clarify and to assure the people who come in that you will not be prosecuted. That the people who would be afraid to come forward might be people who think I will be prosecuted if they know. But if there is an assurance that you will not be prosecuted after you give your details, unless obviously you have committed a crime in the firearm, but you will not be prosecuted, I don't think many people will refrain from coming if they know that they will not be prosecuted. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I hear that the people who will be bringing the grounds can stay anonymous. I just wanted to find out where did you learn this? Where this phenomenon comes from? Is it used elsewhere before? Are you benchmarking? Can you teach us how other countries managed to bring this illegal firearms forward? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think those are the questions. And I think the last round of questions. I just want to say that when we were briefed about the crime death, one of the things that were said to us is that when committing crimes in South Africa, particularly serious crimes such as murder, attempted murder, such as rape and so on, the criminal will usually have or use a firearm as well as an OCAP. That is what we're told. And therefore it means we have many cases there with the police, courts and so on, wherein a person was murdered, firearm was used, and so on and so forth. I think what the members want to be assured of is that there will definitely be balance between the removal of firearms, but of course, avoiding the use of this period in actually destroying evidence. I think that is our worry. Because the firearm, if it was used and it is destroyed, if you're going to destroy it, because I'm still thinking about these drugs that are lost in police stations, as to how you're going to handle this one. That you do not collect firearms and they go back again to criminals. how are you going to handle that in the police stations and ensure that they don't get used as drugs get used in police stations? These are other questions that we personally I have in my mind. But if we can just be clarified on this one, and the issue that if you say anonymous, but I'm happy that you've already indicated that we can remove that, and I should think the members are of the view that that should be removed and move on like that. And I should think the Honorable Fundis Misho is making an important point, that yourself you said the previous amnesty was a success, and information was being taken from those who handed in those firearms. And why now decide not to use that the approach, minimizing the number of papers that you're going to use, of course. But at least I think it has to be done. If I hand over my husband's firearms, why shouldn't you know that it is me who handed it over, for instance? Why should it be anonymous? I should think that should be corrected. Can we get information from your good self so that we can then move on?
I think that we happy to take out no details of the person who hands in the firearms will be taken down. Just take out that last paragraph of that last sentence of paragraph A. I think that there have been anonymous processes in places like this, Brazil, that have worked incredibly well. But we hear what the committee is saying, and I don't think it alters the amnesty process that dramatically. What we would need to do is go back and simplify the process from fact sites to make sure that it doesn't become a burden to fact. And also that whatever simple process is implemented can be audited, because I think that it's very clear that all details of firearms handed in have to be recorded by tax, so we can audit that process to check, because those firearms have to be destroyed within 6 months, so we can audit it. And I think that what we will want to do alongside this amnesty process is have a very strong monitoring process of the amnesty and what happens to the weapons, etc. I just wanted to respond to one thing. We're not talking about profiling of suspects based on the individual policeman. I know that's not what, but it's more around that you do have a concrete list of wanted, very often with photographs of those people that are being distributed. But that's a separate issue. So I just wanted to clarify, it's not about somebody looks suspicious because they're wearing a particular cap or whatever the case may be. So just to clarify that, but I think what we need to do in terms of moving forward is to say that maybe the approach that's been adopted by countries like Brazil, etc., given our situation, is not necessarily applicable. And we take out that sentence, the last sentence under paragraph A. But in terms of what the chairperson is saying, we do need to simplify, but we also need to make sure that the records are accurate and that the process can be audited and the weapons destroyed in 6 months.
Thank you very much for this. If it happens that those firearms get lost at the police station, I think we should just dismiss everything. I'm saying this because the detectives, I think they are from Nelspruit police station or something like that, they are still out there somewhere working and earning. But those drugs have not been found. And I'm saying it on the basis of such things happening within a very short space of time. So 6 months might sound very short and of course it's reasonable. But within a week, a firearm may be lost from the police station. And I'm saying that because I've gone to the police station where this with this big white cupboard, what are they called? Where you safe. You find them wide open. Wide open. And you just don't know as to whether they are supposed to be kept open or what. So I'm saying that there surely must be a way of instilling discipline during this process. We have got to be assured of this, that we're not going to see some firearms getting lost from our police stations, because, you know, they've been handed over and so on and so forth. But thank you very much for that. And therefore, we submission. I have said this is the last round. Now, when it is a pastor who raises his hand, he's not used to being responded to in the church. But let me give you an opportunity, just 1 minute, because you are a pastor.
My apologies, Chair President. In your statement, you raised my curiosity. And Mike, what I want to know is, what do the police have in place to assure us that firearms that are brought in are not going to go back? There is, particularly if they had in mind not to take the names of the people handed them in, how would they verify the numbers that what we have today is exactly what is coming? Because there will be no way of linking who brought which firearm when. If there was no history of firearms and drugs getting lost, one would not have a problem. But now there is a history, and they cannot deny that. So what mechanism do they have in place to ensure that all the firearms that are handed in are not going to be lost, as has been said? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I can quickly run through the process, if a person handed in a firearm, the firearm will be, as I indicated, written into the current book as well as ATP 30. It will be captured in the operation planning and monitoring system. The whole amnesty will be running like an operation. So immediately the station commission within 24 hours must forward us to set up to a national office. Then the firearm is as soon as possible dispatched to the provincial office in respect for the other station. And thereafter, the firearms must be immediately. The moment the firearm, before it can be destroyed, will be linked up with the firearm system. So immediately we will have total control from the moment the firearm has been handed in until the time the firearm has been destroyed. After the firearm has been destroyed, it must be cancelled from the system to link back to the day and the place where the firearm has been handed in. So we run this whole process separately, and it's like an operation that we registered in our system. We did it in the past, Madam Chair, and I can say it worked. For us it worked. There was no problem in respect of that farm. And as the legislation clearly stipulates, we are forced, as soon as possible, to destroy the farm unless the person applies in the meantime for a firearm license for that specific firearm. The same applies. If the person applies, the 14 days after he surrendered the firearm to apply, and we fast track also that process to get it done as soon as possible. This evening. Thank you, Madam.
Just to add to that, that there will be staff audits of the early book where the firearm will be recorded, which will be the role of the Secretary and the Ministry to do those staff audits during the amnesty process, which will be unannounced audits at particular stations.
Thank you very much for that. We therefore moving on to our adoption of this report, with the understanding that the department is going to remove the section that says if the person wishes to utilize the anonymous process for amnesty. And therefore, let me read the report to the portfolio committee, which, if we agree with, we'll have to adopt. Report of the portfolio committee on police on the draft notice for declaration of amnesty in terms of the Firearms Control Act dated 3 November 2009. The Portfolio Committee on Police, having considered the request for approval by Parliament of the draft notice for declaration of amnesty in terms of the Firearms Control Act 2000, Act No. 60 of 2000, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 139(2)(a) of the Act, approve the said draft notice. Can we move for the adoption? Recommend that the House, in terms of Section 139(2)(a) of the Act, approve the said draft notice as amended.
May I ask a question for clarity? You only spoke about the latter part of Section A, where it says, if a person wishes not to, that says, if the person wishes to utilize the anonymous process for amnesty, that part will be removed. But what I think I hate from the secretariat is that it starts from no details of the person who has decided amnesty will be taken. It must start from no details.
That's from no details.
Okay. In fact, it starts from not the case of the person who hands in the firearm will be taken.
Yes, yes.
And that is the amendment we're talking about. Now, I'm sorry about that. Yes. My apologies to that. So the amendment that we're talking about, they start from the...
Yes.
They start from... And I read it. Not the case of the person who hands in the firearm will be taken down. If the person wishes to utilize the anonymous process for amnesty, we're saying that should be removed, and that is the amendment we are referring to.
Yes, and the last page. And sorry, Chair, on the last page as well, you're talking about the second last paragraph. Proper audit processes must be put in place to ensure audit records for all firearms surrendered to take up anonymously.
So the amendment talks to the anonymity. And that being removed from this draft. And that is what it was here. Can we go for the adoption? Honorable Ndlovu. Can you please move for the adoption, Mr. Ndlovu? Honorable Ndlovu.
Thank you, Chair. I move the adoption.
It is not taken to adoption.
Thank you very much. We therefore have adopted our committee report, and therefore the department will go ahead and pay the program or process. Thank you very much for that, and thank you for your presentation. And we will indeed be following up on this process. We do hope that it's going to be successful. All of us together will work towards ensuring that it is a huge success. As a portfolio committee, we have direct interest in the whole process. Thank you very much for that. We are going to break for a 5-minute tea time. And after that, the Department of Home Affairs will therefore make its presentation.
Proceedings. In discussion with the Chair, we thought we should just outline the process from now until next week in relation to the Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Bill. As I'm sure we all are aware and know, that decision was taken by the committee to remove the aspects in the bill relating to DNA, and that we'd proceed with the bill relating to aspects relating to fingerprints. Now, the process from here, and which together with the Chair we are hoping will be accepted and we can take forward, is that today, there are hearings today. We are going to have a briefing now today by Home Affairs on the bill. Tomorrow, being Wednesday, the committee will meet and there will be presentations from the Department of Police, the Department of Transport, as well as CETA, State Information Technology Agency. Permission has also been granted to the committee to sit on Friday, and that would be the whole day if necessary. May I just indicate that there have been a number of written submissions which the committee has received. Those submissions were relating to the bill as it was prior to us having agreed to remove the section dealing with DNA. The committee has interacted with those who have made submissions, and we understand that there are two submissions whereby further submissions will be made relating to the issue dealing with fingerprints, and we're expecting to receive those sometime this afternoon, and if that does come through this afternoon, it will be distributed to members this afternoon, otherwise first thing tomorrow morning. So the intention would be that on Friday the committee would meet. As I said, permission has been given at this stage for the committee to meet all day on Friday until 4 o'clock if necessary, for the committee to deliberate on the presentations as well as to take into account the written submissions and to work through processing the bill. Then permission has also been granted for the committee to meet on Monday, that's next Monday the 9th, The intention is to proceed with the bill, to finalize loose ends with the bill, and to adopt the bill on Monday. And then, if all of that takes place as we're wanting to do, the bill will be debated on Thursday, the 12th of November, and permission has been granted, and I understand that's already been slotted in provisionally into the program of Parliament. That is the information that the chairperson has asked me to convey, and I thought I should just convey that so that it enables people to start now making amendments to their diaries, etc. So, honourable members, that's the process I've been asked to convey, and I imagine if anybody's got any queries, I think it would be best that it gets taken up through the committee section as well as with the chairperson of the committee, but that's the process that's been put in place. So, if we can continue then, today we will continue with the Department of Home Affairs who are here, and we would ask them to make the presentation to the committee, and then obviously afterwards we would have a time for interaction questions. The state law advisors I know are here, and they are welcome to make input as well if they feel they would want to make input. But bearing in mind that the presentation today and tomorrow, we will deliberate as a committee on those on Friday. So we need to just make our notes, etc. I see there's a hand here, Honourable Bonnard.
Just one question. Did you at any stage refer to any other public hearings or anything in relation to the bill? During those days?
No, we didn't refer to public hearings. But what I did say is that there have been a number of written submissions that were forwarded to the committee relating to the bill as it was prior to having been to us making these changes. And the committee section has interacted with those who have made submissions. I understand that the response from all of them was that they are quite satisfied with the process that is being undertaken. However, two of the entities or bodies that made submissions have requested to make further submissions, which they're sending through this afternoon.
I'm just wanting to sound a word of caution here. If you remember correctly, public hearings were not held for two other bills, which were then thrown out by the Constitutional Court. So I just don't want to ever be involved in a committee that has that sort of problem.
No, just to indicate that an advert was placed for the bill when it was presented to us for submissions and for those who wanted to make submissions on the bill. And those are the submissions that have been received, and all of those people or entities, organisations that have made submissions have been approached. They have been asked whether they would want to, in this particular process now, with the changes we're making to the bill, I understand they have been asked as to whether they would want to make verbal submissions to appear before the committee. All of them except two have said they are fine with the process. Two have said they would want to make further written submissions, and they are forwarding that to the committee section this afternoon. And if that clarifies your question. Reverend?
I think you answered my question, because if I heard you correctly, my question was the initial program we were given included times for public hearing. That was the initial program. Now, are you saying that has been changed because the people who have made the written submissions have said they do not want to make oral submissions?
That is correct. May I indicate as well that those who have already made submissions had made submissions based on the bill, including the sections dealing with DNA. And what we were advised is that those who have made those submissions have said they would want to make those submissions when we come to deal with the DNA sections of the bill at a later stage, probably whenever that's going to be tabled. And they would then probably, I imagine, some of them might want to make verbal submissions, etc. However, for this process, they have all said, except for two, they are quite comfortable with the process, and only two want to make further written submission. Can I take the Honourable Van Beek and then the Honourable Schaefer?
Jefferson, can I just ask that from the committee section that, as you did indicate that we would get the further submissions from them as soon as they arrived, but that we also get the submissions of those people who didn't indicate they want to make further submissions, so that we can clarify and, you know, just see ourselves that they are actually, what they say about fingerprinting, if they do say anything about fingerprinting.
If I may follow up on that. If the people did say they do not want to make oral submissions, we have to make sure that it was done in writing and not verbally. Because if it is verbally, they might say they were never given the opportunity. So do we have it in writing?
Take the Honourable Schaefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to suggest that we ask for legal advice from our legal advisors, if we have on this committee or somewhere in Parliament, as to whether this is going to satisfy the requirements of public participation. Because, I mean, the last thing we wanted for it to be a problem and thrown out and challenged and so on. I mean, if we could just perhaps get an opinion from them as to whether this is satisfactory.
I'm sure we will do that through the office of the chairperson. We'll take that up. And I think that the committee section has taken note of the request, one that the committee be provided with the presence of the written submissions that have already been sent. Two, there's been a request that those who have said they are comfortable with the process don't want to make verbal submissions, that we get that in writing. So I think it's a fair request, and we'll ask the committee to handle that for us. If I can also indicate that an amended program will be distributed until today, that all members will get the amended program. But basically what it means is that I think we're all going to have to make some sacrifices, look at changing our diaries. I know it's going to be difficult, but certainly it's the intention of the committee to pass this bill before we rise. So if there's no more questions, if we're satisfied with the responses, then I'm going to ask for the Department of Home Affairs. Before I hand over, there are a couple of people. I know that the Honourable Cola Barnard has indicated she needs to leave probably just before 12, thereabouts. Are you okay? Okay. It's Reverend Meshri needs to leave probably just before 12. But I think if we handle this process correctly, I'm sure we can be finished by around about half past 12 at the latest. So I'm going to hand over to the Department of Home Affairs to take us through the presentation. Department of Home Affairs.
Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, it's a good morning. We appreciate and thank you for the opportunity to present in relation to the request that was made to us as a department. May I apologize for the Director General, Mr. Mafofo Ntima, that he couldn't be able to be here. He has then since delegated myself. My name is Wilson Kize, the Director General for Civic Services. I am with my colleague, Silo Makau, who is the acting Director General for Information Systems in the department. We are presenting our slide in response to the bill, Section 15B, and Subsection 1, which then makes a reference to the issue of any fingerprints being checked against a particular system, particularly that of the Department of Home Affairs. As an outline, I would like to indicate that and bring to the members' attention that as a department, we did participate in this bill as part of the committee. We were involved intensely involved in the process of compilation of the bill itself. So we are not necessarily taken aback by any of the content in the bill. Based on that, then we made our inputs in relation to this, and we will start by just indicating that the Department of Home Affairs will capture and store fingerprints of all citizens, including the documented foreigners who are in the country. Originally, the stored fingerprints were just in manual database format, which then became almost impractical to manage. We then eventually decided to have all the fingerprints automated. Subsequently, ANIS then was commissioned in February 2002, and all processing performed in terms of manual database was then electronically captured and transferred and stored in what we call ANIS. The concept ANIS means, in simple and just in a full term, it's Home Affairs Automated and National Information System. In other words, we just use this system to be able to identify people and verify them using the fingerprints that have been captured. So it's Home Affairs National Identification System. That's what it means. The background is that the department, when it captured these records, it became clear that it would take a very long time. When we look at our timeline, it was quite clear that it would take very, very long if we were to use the initial process. So we then embarked on an accelerated process, which was called a back record conversion project. And that was done in May to convert all the digital records and store them in ANIS. The department then established also subsequent to that what we call a disaster recovery system.
I wonder if there's a possibility of just getting the, is it the overhead, the screen you're talking about? So, yeah. But I think let's allow the presentation to continue while they fix it. We have got the manual or the hard copies in front of us, but if they can see if they can fix that. Thanks.
In terms of the name, after conducting that, it was an accelerated process now that we the department embarked upon and made sure that all of them were captured. We then said that as we use the system, you might face serious challenges.
Can I ask the problem just to hold on? I think there's some members who don't have the hard copy. Can we just wait for them to get that? Otherwise, it's going to be difficult to follow. We are busy on page 3, and until we've got the overhead working, can we just indicate as you go to the next page, which page? But apologies, I thought all members did have the presentation. If you can proceed, please.
Thank you, Chair. The department then accelerated the process of capturing and automating these fingerprints and onto ANIS, and that was in 2005. To make sure that we've got a backup system, we then also commissioned what we call a disaster recovery system, which then helps us to, in case there is any disaster that struck the main system, we are able then to fall back on it for business continuity purposes. To date then, we are talking approximately 33 million sets of fingerprints that have been captured in ANIS, of which, as we have started with the process also of capturing the photos of people, we also now capture them, and we have already stored about 12 million. The photographs are only, we capture them as and when people apply, because we always need a recent photo from a person who applies for an ID, not an old photograph. So we are in that process of populating so that the fingerprints are always matched with also the photographs of the people. So you've got then three things, the fingerprints, the ID number, as well as the photographs. Each of the ANIS architectural structure, and I will ask as we move to the next page, that Mr. Makau, who is our IT digital person in the department, that he is able to talk to this architectural infrastructure. I will then proceed if the chair, honourable chair, allows.
Thanks, Chairperson, honourable members. This is the design, the current design of the Home Affairs National Identification System. The first block just saw the image capture, that's where we capture images. And the second block is harness control subsystem, which comprises, if you go to the far right hand side, it comprises of two databases, the one which is for male and the other one which is for female. And within both databases, you've got the normal database for citizens, then you've got the case file for foreigners, and we also provided a section for health. That's where we were requested that we provide a space for, you know, the health people that will be working in the country, the Cuban doctors and so forth, and there's a space again for training and review. It is both in the male and the female database. The section that shows, the block that shows CETA is a normal process that all government departments are following, that the information before it goes out, it needs to go through the CETA network, obviously for security reasons and so forth. And then of course, as we have mentioned, we have the Home Affairs Disaster Recovery System that is hosted at CETA, so that if we have a disaster in our Pretoria head office, then we have a fallback plan to make sure that our database or our fingerprints are still protected. And of course, from CETA, you know, the information will go to various remote stations, our service points, when people are verifying their fingers, when they're applying for IDs, they will still go through that process. In a nutshell, that's how the system is designed. Now, if you look at the requirements from police and other government departments, social development, city of Joburg, you know, other government departments that requested to interface into the department, is that we will design a link which is almost complete. But obviously from those government departments or those stakeholders, they will need to do some work from their side to make sure that their system can communicate with our system. We actually have done a pilot with the bank, I think because of, you know, capacity available in private sector, they were quicker to really do the design from their side. We have done a pilot with seven banks, including the Big Four, and it was successful. We're currently doing the stress testing to make sure that, you know, when the bank is sending a lot of transactions, we are able to cope with the current system. And that's what we are basically doing. We also provided, had a discussion with the various clusters, including the JPS cluster, where there's justice, police, and so forth. And I think the technical guys in IT are aware of these issues that I'm speaking about now. So in a nutshell, Chair, this is the current architecture of the Home Affairs HANIS and how we will extend to going forward.
As a sign of business continuity we spoke about, I will then continue from where he left over. The ACES design, as I indicated then, HANIS or Home Affairs National Identification System have got various components because it was designed with a number of things that it was supposed to do for the country. And one of those is what we call ACES. Now ACES is the one that means Automated Fingerprint Identification System. What then this one is done...
Sorry, that just to indicate a moment, we're on page 5, I think, eh?
Yes, and where it says ACES design.
Thanks.
So what it means then is that this was designed for civilian purposes. In other words, it was meant just really for verification of civilians. Once we've captured them, citizens of the country, we then store their fingerprints, the 10 sets of fingerprints. However, out of that, it was clear that for purposes of verification, you don't need to have all the time people being verified using all the 10 fingerprints. So we then decided in the design to have the front end of ACES interface with the HANIS just to use what we call the thumbprint. So that when you go, those who honorable members who might have visited Home Affairs offices recently, there is what we call online fingerprint verification system. That is what it does. It verifies you while you are there, and all you do, you just use your left or your right thumbprint, and then you are able to verify while you are in the office, through head office, using online verification, fingerprint verification. So, yes, that is what then it does. We do not currently store children's fingerprints on the database for various reasons, because this is meant for people that we need who will be applying for identity documents. And therefore, then there are no children's fingerprints on the database. The separate databases exist for documented foreigners. And the system, as Silo has indicated, that we then have designated compartments in the system. Then the one that is called case file covers what we call contract workers, refugees, because the refugees receive an ID, but it tells the difference. Its last number is the 18 number. The permanent residents receive an ID, which is called similar to the very South African ID, but those who are permanent resident, you then receive an ID that is last 3 digits. It's a 18 number. So a South African ID is not the same as a permanent resident. The South African one ends with a 08 number. The one for the foreigner or the permanent resident ends with a 18 number. That is the difference with the ID number between the one of the permanent resident and the one of a citizen of the country. So in a nutshell, we do store those fingerprints also. There is a high availability and reliability of the system. And it has been tested even recently just to make sure that the system, we always know that its uptime is always available and is quite reliable. Now, when we move to the key question, and that is the next slide, Honorable Chairperson, titled ACES Possibilities of Integration with SARS. This is our response naturally to this question and the request by the portfolio committee. Potential definitely exists for the amendment of the HANIS ACES system so that the integration with SARS can take place. I will not go into detail because this has been tested with other with SAPRIC and it was quite successful. That pilot we completed it in August, as Mr. Makau has indicated. We are now having moved to the next stage. So we believe that the potential for the interface and the integration is quite possible, and then also for the searching of crime scene latent fingerprints against of the DNA database. This can be done. This will also allow a one-to-many. When you look at that, it says one-to-n. Because the system is designed in a manner that you can do what we call a one-to-one verification, where you just want to check whether this fingerprint exists. But if it is someone that might not be in the system, we are seeing the fingerprint for the first time, you then throw the system and tell it that search against the 33 fingerprints that are in the system. Then the system will check against all whether there is no match with any of the fingerprints in the system. So that is what we call one-to-many. The one-to-one verification, as I've explained, could also be done through SARS network to the DHA system, as long as the ID number is available. Manual verification and the current protocols, really, of fingerprint verification and photo, if ID number is available, is also possible, because we did not destroy the manual records, they are still available. But also we've got people who are also fingerprint experts in the department, who are also responsible for, if you don't use electronic means, they always are capable and trained in fingerprint technology, so they understand it quite well. The current protocol is that then, because this will not be the first time yet, we are working with the staff already, where they would send their own request to us, and we are able to then use that and just verify whether those fingerprints are in the system or not, and are for the person who is identified as the owner of a particular ID. So we already have quite a positive relationship with SARS in that regard. And in relation to implications of changes that might be required, we have chosen here, and it is in the next slide that talks to the implications of changes. to say that really the changes are mainly related to the integration and the interface. However, as we have indicated even to the committee that was working, the subcommittee that was working on this bill, we were very clear that there are issues that will need to be in terms of protocol, because there are usually issues of sensitivities about people's fingerprints, that there will be a need to have clear protocol issues that will have to be followed on dealing with this matter. Because the fingerprints, not all people must think that when they submit fingerprints to Home Affairs, it's for the purposes of determining whether they're criminals or not. It is for the civilian people. So when this is communicated to the citizens for them to participate with confidence, it must be clear that there will be protocols that will safeguard those who are not necessarily criminals or being suspected of criminal activities, so that then people have confidence in the system. So we believe that those protocols will have to be developed. Relating to the cost, the cost can only be determined once we have engaged with staff or in relation to what exactly are the implications and what volume will there be, what are the likely volumes that we might be dealing with. The Act does cover us in terms of the Access to Information Act about sharing information between departments. So that we don't think will have much of a problem. But in relation to the costing, that will have to be done between ourselves and staff in looking at that and what are likely to be the capacity volume that we will have to be dealing with. But as a department currently, looking at the size of current ACs, we have already got an approval to, the government has embarked on a process to extend the capacity of ANIS to 70 million. And that process is currently underway, and we are hoping that possibly by December, that the size of the capacity of ANIS will have that. That will then extend the potential to capture more and more fingerprints onto the system. So that is already work in progress. So the issue then of turnaround times for processing, that always depends on what Mr. Macau has indicated, that you always need to do what we call stress testing, because we will have to go through a process that will say, send this information electronically, relay it, and as you relay it, then you are able to measure how long does it take the response time in between, and then be informed of any intervention that might be required. But currently in our local offices, in relation to the processing of a fingerprint, it's usually almost at most 2 seconds, because you just go there and you put your fingerprint. It doesn't really take a lot of time, and we are able to do that. But in cases where it's one too many, where maybe staff might need information but the person has no ID number and we need to check, that is one too many. The current protocol is that it takes around about 24 hours for people to be able to get that information back. So on average, that is what we have. But for one-to-one, a person having an ID number, fingerprint on the system, we're able to respond in that regard. So we don't think that will have any impact if we do integrate. As I've indicated, the issues about extended support as well as maintenance for ANIS will be critical, because the system has to be to have real-time responses but also to be a highly reliable system. And because of other activities we are involved in, already the department has taken a number of initiatives to ensure that the system is reliable, dependable, and is able to provide a response time and that is acceptable. But all those things will really depend more on our engagement with staff, on the implications of changes. What are we doing for the future possibilities as a department? The department has embarked on what we call, we are conducting research, we are looking at possibilities that can happen here. One of them is the issue of facial recognition, and that we can be able to integrate into the system. We are already capturing the photographs that I've indicated of people onto ANIS. The issue of watch list at port of entry, strategic events, and so that then you can have even a portable equipment that wherever you are, as you move around, you can be able to use in terms of facial recognition and be able to determine people. This is also linked to other means of biometric verification that we are exploring, which we have seen in other countries already taking place, like the iris, the use of iris, and we are exploring those things. There is no firm decision by the department on this matter, but just for future policy possibilities and looking at where biometric usage is in other countries internationally. If you go to Japan, as you went to the airport, one of the biggest airports, the first thing they ask for you is, of course, the iris. You go there, they capture your iris. So it's not a big issue. When you go to Dubai, they do the same thing. You go to UAE, they do the same thing in terms of trialing and testing these things. So we believe that these are future possibilities that Home Affairs can embark upon and look at options that are available to it. Children's fingerprinting really is just for the purposes of what the minister announced, to separate the application of an ID from capturing the databases of or the details of the children, so that by the time your age comes for you to apply for an ID, you have your ID number secured, everything linked to you. So it is not about for any other purpose really. We are busy with that research, and we are at an advanced stage about that, just to see how it can work. But it's exactly for that purpose, just to see how we can separate the use of application for an ID from taking the details of personal details of children or people. Also, the possibility is a one-to-one verification from remote stations. We are currently only doing this at our local offices. But if you look at the possibilities of doing that, it is quite clear that with technology available nowadays, we should be able to do those things. So in a nutshell, our response to Section 15B is that we believe that the possibility of integration is possible, and that we've got a huge database of fingerprints and in an automated format, and as Home Affairs, we can possibly make a positive contribution towards this venture. And I'm not sure if anything technological that Silo would like to add, Jefferson.
Thank you, Chair. I think Mr. Mkhize has, in a nutshell, captured what was the purpose of us presenting here. But in addition, we just want to highlight that in order for us to be able to determine how long will this interface take, it's important that we get clear requirements from the police in terms of what exactly the police would want to see, you know, the turnaround time in terms of the system, so that we can determine all those things, you know, from the technical point of view, and make sure that we don't frustrate, you know, the police as one of our stakeholders when the system is in a live environment. So that will actually also determine the requirements, the business requirements, will determine the cost and the time frame that it will take to obviously implement this. And this will be a huge project, because it would require both the IT team from SEFS and Home Affairs to work together. Because while the interface will be designed within Home Affairs Department, there will be some work that needed to be done from the SEFS system so that there's that communication. Thank you.
Thanks very much. That's the presentation from Home Affairs, Department of Home Affairs. I'm going to open up to members now that would ask or want to ask questions. I'm going to start here. Let me take the Honourable Schaefer, then I'll go to Honourable Van Beek, Honourable Kola Barnard, and Reverend Meshwi, and then Bobon Lovell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, you mentioned a number of times if an ID number is available. Does that mean you have to have an ID number to be able to verify fingerprints? Because that could be a problem, obviously, especially people who don't have ID books. And is there a way around that if that is the case? Secondly, what procedures do you have in your system to enable people to track who is actually looking at these fingerprints? What sort of security systems do you have in place in case of abuse? And there was another one which I've forgotten. Thanks.
Well, fine, thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is around the last comment that was made in terms of the requirements of SEPS, etc. Now, up to this stage, was there any discussions with such in terms of the requirements, and will the Department of Home Affairs enter into agreement with a memorandum of understanding of some sort with such on this issue? Because, Chair, I think we don't want a process where either one of the two departments become frustrated because of what is required and not being delivered, or what is required and cannot be delivered, or that such come with unrealistic requirements as well. So, you know, maybe somewhere in the legislation one should also make provision for a clear memorandum of understanding between the two departments, and ask that such a memorandum of understanding that this, and maybe also with the Department of Transport, that they make a section in, draft a section in the bill that requires the departments involved to get to a memorandum of understanding of what can be provided and what, against what time frames, etc., etc. Just to make sure that they don't run into future problems. Can you just comment on that?
Reverend Meshwe. Sorry, Honourable Colaborn.
I was also going to bow to the Reverend here. I think we've given you enough pepper from Cleveland for one day. Yes, a couple of questions. I'm interested in that. What we're doing here is taking a civilian database of freely given fingerprints, and we are allowing access, allowing those fingerprints now no longer to be used for merely administrative purposes in relation to ID documents and the like, but now to give access to SAPs. In other words, it will now be utilized as a database of potential criminals to seek them out. I'm interested, and we may have to go to the law advisors here, about the fact that the fingerprints were freely given for one purpose, and they're now given, being handed over for another purpose. I just want to see that we don't, it seems to me it's something of a legal minefield there. And I've done a lot of reading up on this matter, and it seems to me that in many countries, such a database is, once it is looked at from the security sector point of view, they have an independent advisory structure to advise the custodians of the database. I don't know in terms of the legislation if this in fact would be allowed, but I certainly would be interested in your input, because of the dramatically different change in terms of your database and the use thereof. I'm also interested in your document. Why are there so few photographs in relation to the sets of fingerprints? There are 12 million photographs, 33 million sets of fingerprints. So that's just something of a curiosity to me. And I'm also interested, I know the civilian fingerprint database did tend simply to do a thumbprint, whereas the sets tend to need all prints. How does one overcome that as a problem? If you only have the thumbprint and they've actually picked up one of the other digits, what is the use? I know you passed over it and the Access to Information Act, but I'm very interested in the actual phraseology of the auspices under which you as a ministry were granted the right to create and maintain such a database in relation to the sharing of information interministerially. I just want to make sure we don't have a hurdle there to overcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Ms. Conceiver says fingerprints are matched with photos. Now, when I look at the number of photos, compared to the set of fingerprints, they don't match. Now, how do you do that? How do you match that? And secondly, I want to know how many prints are in a set? Because we talk about a set. How many prints are in a set? And Also, he said not all fingerprints are stored within 8 weeks. Am I correct in saying all the fingerprints that are in APIS are in hand? Now, if all the fingerprints in APIS are in hand, why have a duplication? Because it seems everything that is in APIS is in hand, but not everything in hand is in APIS. So why should you have APIS separately when everything in APIS is in hand? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I want to understand the definition of children. It's very important to know how do they define children on their own in home affairs. How do they define it? Where does children end? Because you see, on slide 5, they talk about no children's fingerprints are stored. But when it comes to slide 8, the focus is children's fingerprints. Now, how do they define that? Where do they cross the bridge from 1 to 2? 2, Chairperson, in slide 8, verification from remote stations. What does remote mean? Means rural area or what? Does it apply to the rural areas? Do we have a link up with the rural areas and so on and so forth? Because if we talk about remote, which remote are we talking about here? Is it the Home Affairs or in police station? Is what? So that we are clear of what we are talking about. Lastly, Chairperson, we talk about the negotiation. I think the engagement with JALSA, which Anil van Wyk was talking about, the engagement with SAP. I think there must be an understanding of what we need from them, Home Affairs, and what we need from SAP. Because if Home Affairs come with their own timetable, and SAP cannot match the timetable, then we have a problem. Then we must know how do they meet, how do they come together in order to synchronize the work that has been done. If they agree that we must work together, that will include the transport too, because everybody is using the fingerprint and so on and so forth. Thank you very much, Chair.
Okay, I've seen some other hands, but we'll take those in the second round. If I can ask Home Affairs to respond, but there was also, in the responses, there was also a question about relating to the legal implications, use of a civilian database by SAPS for criminal investigations. So once Home Affairs has responded, if we can ask the state law advisors to maybe make some input there if they would like to. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. We will share the responses with my colleague. Firstly, on the issue of the unavailable, if you don't have an ID number, we have indicated there are two kinds of verification that the ANIS is capable of doing. One is a one-to-one, and the other one is a one-to-many. The one-to-many is used where you don't have possibly don't have an ID number. We're still able to do that verification, but it's what we regard as one-to-many, because it means you've never been on ANIS, possibly. So we throw your set of fingerprints, and then the system checks. Is the one that I said it takes about 24 hours currently at most on average time, because then it checks against all the fingerprints. The one-to-one just looks for those minutiae that are identical to what has been posted onto the system to say such as it. So that is the difference between the two. On the issue of the security process that is in place, I think Silo will deal with that. SAP's requirements and CELO also will deal with that, but I think it is a welcome comment and advice that will need to be definitely taken up. But if CELO has any comment, I think he will do so. But from our side, I think it is a well-considered advice. We are establishing MOUs with every institution that tries to have relationship with us in this manner, in this regard. Same thing, I don't think we are not legal experts. We have always thought that that's why, even in our presentation initially, we indicated the issue of a need for protocol that will have to be established to deal with this matter. Because if we don't do that, it is very likely that it might cause apprehension as well as maybe areas of sensitivities around citizens. Citizens would like to be assured that I am not being looked at as a criminal as I move around. So there will be a need for that, but I think the chair has advised about state law advisors looking into the matter and maybe working within the legal services department in our department. The issue of why so few photographs, I think you will deal with that. But the main thing is that really when we take applications, we need a recent photo for a person. When we were automating these fingerprints, the photographs that were there were very, very old. It would have been almost impossible to use those photographs. There was a need to get a recent photo because then we know we're dealing with a person. Because human face changes sometimes as people grow. Or as people get involved in accidents. So we need your recent photograph. So that is why then the fingerprints were prior away were taken, because it was clear the fingerprints of human beings don't change. Once they are there, they remain, and once they are taken at that age, they remain the same. So your minutia will not change. But the age of the face and facial recognition becomes important to that. So that is the only reason why there is a mismatch at this stage between those figures. Is that there was an accurate fingerprint, but for the photo, we definitely need the new one. So if people come on board, we then have to begin within our architecture to capture those for new different also design the system so that it does capture the photograph in a manner that we will be able to be accessible. How do we overcome the issue of the thumb vis-a-vis the 10 fingerprints? As we have indicated, if we look at slide number 5, if I'm not mistaken, under ancient design, we have indicated there that yes, everything, atheist is part of harness. Now what happens is that then, here the purpose is really about just matching the fingerprints, but the database will have implications about what exactly do we have to do, so that then the system can be told, go and extract the 10. Fingerprints rather than only the thumbprint. So that is part of what we would to deal with during the integration discussions with staff and be able to look at and deal with those things. But both these two systems, it's not that the other one is different from the other. It's just that the design was such that for purposes of verification in a front office, then you access those two as soon as possible. Not that they are not accessible, they are available. It's only the same system that we have. It's not two different systems, just its components. And it was depending on the design, on the purpose, why you needed to extract only those. But all of the fingerprints are there.
So can I stop you there? I think the Honourable Kola Bola just wants to ask something in relation to your answer now.
Just a follow up there, sorry, for point of clarity. In your home affairs database, you frequently only have the thumbprint, and you said, okay, once it's linked to SAPS, it can be sent out to search for the rest, but you're presuming that the rest of the fingerprints exist elsewhere. They're not currently on a SAPS database, because 99% of the people included here will never have committed a criminal act. So I wasn't sure where your database is going to be searching for those other fingerprints if the person has never given them up. Please just clarify for me.
When someone is arrested, for example, they have a responsibility to take fingerprints of people, and they then send those to us for us then to be able to verify them against the database we have. And that is where we're talking about then one too many if you don't have an ID. But if you have an ID, we just then use your fingerprints that you have submitted or SAPS will submit to us, and then we verify it against the system. On the on the issue then of how do we match photos to fingerprints, I think that, that I have answered that in terms of why the difference that we have currently. So we are hoping that eventually as all people get the apply and renew their IDs if there is a need, we will continue to capture them as they come forth. All fingerprints in Hanif, okay, I believe I have answered that question, and let the Honourable Chair advise us differently. The issue of the age of children, in terms of the Identification Act, we only take fingerprints of people who are turning 16. Because then, in terms of the Act, at the age of 16, you should have been ID. And therefore, then, that is where our cutoff point is. And because at that age, you must have an ID when you turn 16. Once you are 16 years old and whatever, and the department, in terms of policy, is compulsory that South Africans must have an identity document. I think Silo will touch the other two questions, including what do you mean by a remote system.
Can I stop you there? Do you have a measure you want to ask a question? And I continue, let's see if that question will be answered.
Thanks, Chair. On the issue around the security system to check who's using it so that there's no abuse, we have what we call the biometric access control management system, whereby even the user of the system must log in with a password but still using fingerprint to authenticate. Because in this case, we can check who has actually logged into the system because every person's finger is unique. So we have that system, we can clearly check who has been using the system. We are actually upgrading the system to ensure that in addition to those, we will have a smart card again that you'll plug it in addition to fingerprints and so forth, just for us to enhance the security. The issue around any discussion with SEP, I think in various forums in the cluster as well, this issue has been discussed. I think what we haven't done is really to formalize the requirements between the department and SEP. And I think that's the next step that we need to do so that, because we are comfortable as Home Affairs that, you know, we are ready to start, you know, formalizing this and make sure that we kick off or kickstart the project. The fingerprints match with the photo was you. I think that one Mr. Mkhize has actually answered it. The other question was, what does it mean, verification from the remote location? What happened is that this system, the online verification or the fingerprint verification, we have the system in the mobile units. When they are in Bizos, the minister is going around, there will be mobile units whereby people can apply for a birth certificate, the ID, and verify, and that's what we call the remote location. Also, in areas that are not within Home Affairs offices, that's where we refer them as a remote location. We've got other service points like Tucson centers where combination with other government departments, you know, Home Affairs is available there to provide services. So in a nutshell, that's what it means. Thank you.
I just want to check with the Is that all? I think that's all the questions answered. But I think let's just quickly check from the state law advisors whether they want to make any input on the question that came from Honourable Colabod, and then I'll come back to the other hands.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't unfortunately have a voice, so can I ask Mr. Hercules to answer? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, with regard to the use of fingerprints, that is catered for under Chapter 5, Capital A, in terms of the amendments before the committee. Specifically deals with the use and storage of fingerprints retained, and subsection 4 deals with the the specific use for that, for the fingerprints, and it says that it may only be used for the purposes related to the detection of crime and investigation of an offence or conduct of a prosecution. So it's for a very limited purpose that it can be used. And should any person abuse the information with regard to fingerprints or the use thereof, there is also a sanction provided for in the proposed amendment before the committee, and such a person will be guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 15 years. Furthermore, with regard to, that is also applicable with regard to speculative searches against other databases such as the Department of Home Affairs, where the same sanction would apply. And then furthermore, with regard to the sharing of databases, and 15C provides for the National Commissioner, in consultation with the Minister, to issue national instructions with regard to all matters that are reasonably necessary or expedient to provide for in relation to the storage and detention of fingerprints and the use thereof, to be followed by police officials. So that is basically currently what the proposed amendment provides for in the bill. And of course, with regard to the practicalities, that is something that the decided with the department as to how they're going to see to that. But with regard to, there will be national instructions, so maybe we can look at that and try and see if we can tighten that as well as we go along. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks very much. What I'm going to do, there was one hand here, and before I took the final questions, if we can take the Honourable Lefetter, and then if we can come back to the Honourable Cotter Barnard and the Honourable Meshwe.
Thank you, Chair. You are saying that if you make a fetch one-to-one, it takes 2 seconds, and it takes 24 hours for those without ID. Just wanted to check with you, who are these people without ID? Where do they come from? Thanks.
Thank you. I just want to check up on citizens' rights in relation to, and I, having looked internationally, there is no system in existence, storage system, that I have read of that is 100% secure. So not only that, but we also, of course, have the possibility of human error, which is indeed was pointed out by the research documents provided to us when we began this exercise, which could result in, for example, fingerprints being incorrectly labeled in one or other of the databases, which could cause then difficulties. And that possibility of human error would mean that we have to have built in some sort of recourse for citizens who suddenly are told that their fingerprints have appeared at a crime scene that they have never visited. And really, I think we need to know that the citizens' rights are safe in this regard. I'm also quite interested to hear Home Affairs saying, well, they would have the security responsibility for what is basically a joint database between themselves and the SAT. Now, are SATs not going to in any way be involved in the security of this? Does it fall completely under Home Affairs? Is there a section under SAT? Do SATs have access? Has this all been drummed out? Because we actually need to know.
Chair Chairperson, we were made to understand that the system of HANIS is foolproof, that it cannot be tampered with. But we have heard of stories of foreigner being on the database illegally. And some of us, some of that, because of that, some would end up having IDs and other important documents. Now I want to know, how did they get on the system? If the security is that tight, it sounds to me that there are abuse of the system. And the massive rate of people that are that have ended on the Home Affairs database, some of whom who did not even have a birth certificate. How does that happen? Thank you.
Thank you, Jefferson. You see, I'm interested to know the particulars of MOUs that will be between the subs and the Home Affairs. I'm very particular on that because it will link up exactly of what do they want, what our old member Colbert will say, who's going to keep what. Because if the MOU does not give us a clear mandate, who is the custodian of whatever, then we have the subs will always be liable at the end of the day to be sued. Not Home Affairs. But in the meantime, the Home Affairs will be keeping the database. Now, I'm very interested in the MOUs. How will the MOUs look like? And have they had it before? With which department? Because we are talking about the chairperson, we are talking about transport. There is transport, they use the fingerprint when you go to a license. There is this SAPS, because when you're applying for firearms, and then some of them when you're applying for ID. There's a different people. Therefore, will the MOU only apply to SAPS only, or does it apply to everybody who's using the fingerprint? That's my question, and the safety after that. Thank you.
Honourable Mekhesa, you want to ask a follow-up?
Yeah, thanks, Jefferson. You're saying that the department captures and stores fingerprints of all citizens and documented foreigners. I just wanted to check with you, how many do we have these documented foreigners in this country, and how many undocumented foreigners do we have in this country? Thanks.
If the department wants to answer it, they can, but let's take the answers to the department on the various questions.
Thanks very much, Chair. Maybe what I find is there are things that might be bordering on legalities that we might not be able to respond to, and therefore then we would request the honourable members to be patient with us in those areas that we believe we might not be qualified to respond to, because they might have very legal implications. But on matters of the nature of the honey system, we will respond according to the best of our abilities. And on the issue of who is without ID and where do they come from, I believe that the honourable members are possibly okay with the issue of, for example, what we call the late registration of birth project that the department is about to make sure that all citizens of South Africa who are not yet documented do have access to a birth certificate as well as an ID. Now, we do have such citizens in the country, and we do have to search their names and be able to then determine whether on the database they have never applied for an ID or have never captured their applications before. But there are people who, for various reasons, might try to also change their own identity and claim that they were not, they never had an ID. So, we always have to make sure before we process the application that we have checked your fingerprint, that you've never applied for an ID before,
and that you have not also been issued an ID before. That is why we need to then have a particular category of the system. It can then be anyone who is picked up as a person who says, I'm also coming forward. I need to apply for an ID. It's just a protocol thing for us to make sure that everyone who is in this country gets documented, and that you must be able to check your fingerprints against the system that we already have. And if you're not there, we'll make sure we capture that. That is mainly the issue around that. So when we talk of foreigners, we've got people who are in the country legally, and for definition of foreigners, there we've got people like refugees who are in the country legally, we still have to document their fingerprints. We've got contract workers or foreigners who also special skills required, who are then in the country. We need to document them. So, and when we talk of various sectors of foreigners, it includes also then you will remember, honorable members, that there was a problem of an unfortunate incident of xenophobia in the country. And there were a certain number of people who then came out of the woods. And some of them were not documented, and Home Affairs had to go around in those centers that were established to capture their database and their fingerprints. But if they're not there, we have to make sure that we capture them. So there are various reasons why we have to have that particular category catered for. On the issue of the name citizens' rights, I believe that we, or before I move to that one, how many documented foreigners? On our database currently, the figure that we have is, I would just say, give us approximately 2.5 million people on that category of foreigners we're talking about in the system. And that is why we say it's the half of what we call case file. And then on the issue of undocumented and how many, if we knew, honorable members, we will definitely have them documented. Unfortunately, we don't know them, and therefore we can't tell you the volume on how many they are. So it's unfortunate we are not able to give you a concrete answer on how many are out there undocumented. In correct identification and possibility of the issue of human rights, citizens, no system is 100% secure. And this is a question I would like to tread quite carefully around this matter, because I think issues of ethical issues do come to the fore here, the rights of citizens. So I will be extremely reluctant, except to talk about what we do about audit trade, secure the process itself. And that's the only level I can think we should be able to respond to, if honorable members allow it. And then on the issue of incorrect identification, possibility of human error, yes, that is possible, it can happen, it does happen. But what we then normally do is that there is always, as I've indicated, the department did not destroy the other manual records. So there is always an opportunity also of a second line to be able to go back and really confirm and check whether really was there any possibility of human error, and therefore then you've got wrong identification of a person. As long as that comes to our fore, we are able to then attend to that as a department, because we are not necessarily, as honorable member has indicated, saying that the system is 100% secure. We do encounter such, but based on our experience, we are able to resolve such incidents where they occur. On the issue of people who have got to the system and are non-South Africans, I believe the minister, one of the key things that she has been able to profile around the department's challenges is the issue of corruption. Inevitably, indisputably, she has come forth and said we have a problem of corruption. And therefore then we still admit that we do have that challenge of corruption. But as we have always said, that it also takes two to be corrupt. There are people also in the country, and that's why we've got a new process called the late registration of birth, and it was revised to tighten the process. Because these people who get into the system in that fashion, they are assisted sometimes by the very same South African citizens who pretend that they know them. They will provide documentary proof that no, this person is definitely born and bred here in my area, or I baptized this person, or he attended this school. So Home Affairs, based on that, then would end up using the information available and will put people on the database. So there are problems of corruption that we have, but as Mrs. Sillo is saying now, we are also trying to secure the process. But this is an issue of a culture change, as a sense of also commitment to protect citizenship of this country. It's a patriotic issue that needs all South Africans to work towards that identity of South Africa cannot be for sale. And our commitment is, when we educate our citizens, that generally in the country, those in the authority should assist us to begin to drive that message that citizenship of South Africa can't be for sale. It's a priceless asset for the country. And we believe that we should be able to get there. But it's a culture change, it's a conduct change that will definitely need to be dealt with. And we are doing our bit, but processes and systems alone cannot necessarily eliminate the problem. It's something that needs a comprehensive strategy, as government-wide and generally in every public sector and generally in society. So, yes, there are some incidents, but where we get you and where the department finds you, we'll make sure that you leave the country, because then you are non-citizens. We do investigate such incidents. But the LRP process also tries to make sure that it is difficult for people to get onto the system of Home Affairs unless we have satisfied ourselves that you meet certain criteria in that regard. I'm not sure about the MOUs. Silo can talk to that just briefly, because we have the experiences. But on an anticipated MOU, it will be difficult to preempt what should be in that MOU, because it will need both parties to agree on a memorandum of understanding. But with our experiences on the number of MOUs we have and are developing, Silo might use that as a benefit of experience from his side. Thank you, Chair.
Yes. Another further input from Home Affairs, I think.
Yeah. I think, Chair, the Honourable Member has asked a question around one-on-one, which is taking 2 seconds, and the other one, which is taking 24 hours. Maybe just to clarify this, is that with one-on-one, there are two things that you need to have. Is a fingerprint and the ID number that is linked, that they are linked to each other. So when you put the fingerprint on the scanner, that fingerprint information or that ID, it goes directly and look for the fingerprint, and that's why it takes that 2 seconds. Now, if you don't have the ID, we have fingerprint, maybe they've taken your fingerprint somewhere, and now we want to check if you really exist in the database, then the system will take your fingerprint and goes around all 33 million records and check each and every finger to see if it can match there. That's why in that case it takes a longer than when you have your ID and your fingerprint. On the system, on the issue around the system lack of guarantee of the security of the system, I think I agree there's no system in the world that is 100% secure. I think what we do is we keep on putting measures to enhance the system as we continue. I've alluded earlier on that even though we have a biometric system where people will use their fingerprint, we're still now adding other security features like the smart card to make sure that we can really, beyond reasonable doubt, track who has actually performed the same transaction. In fact, the project that we are currently embarking is that we make sure that when people are working, our people working on the system, say for example, he's in the process of capturing a birth certificate, in all the pages, he must still authenticate so that even when he prints the certificate, it will be beyond reasonable doubt that it was Silo who printed the certificate, because we used to have cases whereby somebody would log in once and then some activities were done, corrupt activities, and she or he would claim that, well, I went to the bathroom, maybe somebody came in and performed some transactions. So now we know that
if you leave the system and go to the bathroom, before you can do any other thing, you have to authenticate, and we will trace that you have printed this certificate, even though the capturing was done by somebody else. So those are the measures that we put in place to enhance the system. The other thing that we are doing, obviously, a system that does not, is not linked to processes might be useless as well. So we're actually mapping our processes into the system to make sure that, you know, people understand what needs to be done to perform certain activities. On the issue around the responsibility of SEP on the security issues, again, this is not the Home Affairs responsibility alone. Part of the requirements that will be coming, and this is what we get from other stakeholders, is that when you provide those requirements, one of the specifications will be that the security features that we need is 1, 2, 3, so that we can see, we make sure that we incorporate those security features into the system, so that we make sure that this system meets your requirements as a stakeholder. It's not only for Home Affairs, but the stakeholders need to satisfy themselves in terms of the security issues. The particulars and the terms of reference for MOU really differ from one stakeholder to another, because there are different requirements from different stakeholders. But in a nutshell, it will even go beyond the issues around support and maintenance, the availability of the system, beyond normal working hours, you know, whose role is this in terms of making sure that when the system is down, the calls are lost and so forth. So it really differs from one stakeholder to another. That's all I wanted to say, Chair. Thank you.
I'll take Honourable Luketa and Honourable Colabono. Those would be the last hands, I think, that we'll take.
Thanks, Chair. I thought it is the responsibility of Women First to repatriate people in the country, and I've seen that so often. I want to find out why is that happening. Do they have documents? Why do you take them back if they are documented? Thanks.
Yeah, I think what I want to just... I beg your pardon.
I heard the question as being asking the department as to why people are sent back to countries. Maybe the Honourable Luketa, you can just rephrase your question. We'll just raise it again.
I will do that. Babanzo, I'm saying to the department that I thought their responsibility to repatriate people out of this country, and that happens often in the recent past. Now, my question was, why are they doing that? Why should they repatriate documented people? Thanks.
I just wanted to add in perhaps the word of caution to Home Affairs. And then while they have suggested that the security for this extended database, the security will fall under the SAP, we're not dealing now with individuals who would quite like to have an ID book or pay one of your staff R1,000 to somehow get their fingerprints in there and register them under the carpet. We're actually dealing with multi-million rand drug syndicates who will shoot you as soon as look at you. And if they can get their fingerprints out of that database, if they know, yes, I have an ID book, previously SAP did not ever have my fingerprints. And now with this amalgamation of the databases, suddenly you are under an enormous personal threat. And they will come and they will wipe your entire staff out, stroll in there, and if needs be, cut one of their fingers off to open your system. It's that easy. So I'm just sounding a little word of caution here. This is now moving you into the big leagues of really murderers. who think nothing of what your life is worth. So please, when we're talking security, deal with SAP extensively and look internationally for how best to protect yourselves and your staff and the database, because this really is and could be a recipe for disaster for Home Affairs.
The Honourable Mulabasi is begging me to ask her a question, so I'll allow her, and that will be the last question.
Thank you, Captain. Mine is slightly outside this bill, but it has to do with Home Affairs. I want to know about the corrupt officials who are suspended. I know it's a big number. What happens? Are they still being paid? And if they are still being paid, how long will they stay? Because I know some of them have been suspended for so long. Thanks.
Can I hand over to the department to answer? And then also just to check, I wanted to check from the state board by the side whether there's anything else that they wanted to add.
Thank you for the opportunity. All that we can say in respect of that, the question that was raised by Honourable Member Kwalabona was with regard to the what security measures are in place and how would you protect a person's fingerprints where the person's fingerprints are not are taken on a crime scene. The current status will remain as is currently provided for in the Criminal Procedures Act. And furthermore, protection is afforded in the legislation that only an expert can analyse the DNA of the fingerprints of a person found on a crime scene. So there's an affidavit must be made by an expert regarding that process of analysing the fingerprints. And furthermore, as is indicated already, that using a fingerprint against contrary to the intention of the bill as it currently stands, would then create an offence in terms of the legislation. So a person is protected in that sense as well. And I think furthermore the practicalities, if we can ask the department to also just comment there on, because I think that is something that must be addressed by the department as well, please. Thank you.
The department, if you can respond, please.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. I think the issue around why repatriate people who are documented. The department repatriates people in terms of Immigration Act. There are two categories of people that can be repatriated in a nutshell, just to summarize. It's people who are regarded as you might just enter the country but you commit crime when you were initially in the country as a person of good standing. But when you become within the country an undesirable element, because you will then get involved in whatever crime that you are while you were here under the good judgment of South African government allowing you to stay in the country. And then you commit such crime that it warrants your status to be reviewed. The department, I think, has that responsibility then to make sure that such undesirable elements are not kept in the country. The second category is people who are in the country illegally. Even if we document you in terms of keeping your records that you were here, it becomes necessary, and that's why if we look at the minister's heightened approach around issues of managing immigration, she has been very clear even about linking of systems in the different ports of entry, so that if you were once patriated also illegally, you can then be verified and be picked up as you enter into the country. Or if you enter illegally, then using other means, as long as you can capture it, we still have to make sure that we verify and we can tell that you were once deported, and you have to make sure that you leave the country. So that is those are the nature of repatriation and in a broad category. Without going to finally get further things that get people repatriated. But people who are in this country with honorable intentions don't get repatriated because they are legal, they are documented, and they stay at the required period that they have to be in the country. On the issue of I think the other question really is, it's not a question, but it's more about the sound warning about the possible backlash by syndicates. And I believe that we will take that to heart and we will definitely communicate that to the department and to find a means of being proactive in looking into the possible backlashes and how we can mitigate that. The issue of suspended officials and whether they are being paid or not, will it not be appropriate, because we came here for a different purpose according to the mandate we were given, that then be directed to the department through other means, but for us here it will be a bit difficult to engage on that because we came for a different purpose.
There was a comment by the state law advisors just now, which I'm not too sure if you've responded to. I don't know if they've adequately if they responded to your comment. Maybe you would just reiterate what you said. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. As I've indicated, I think with regards to the practicalities, if attached, can just comment on that. I think that will assist the committee in understanding how the connection and the manner in which they will deal with will be addressed. If we could ask SAPS just to explain that for the purposes of the committee, that was the intention. Thank you, Chairperson.
That question is directed to SAPS. Is there anybody here that's able to respond on that?
Yes, Chairperson. With your permission, honourable members, the process that will be involved once we have lifted a fingerprint from a crime scene, that fingerprint is then scanned into the computer system, and then what is now termed a speculative search is conducted on our own database. If on that database we identify the person, then fine, end of story. Then we continue with the investigation. Should it appear that we do not find that fingerprint on our system, that fingerprint is then sent digitally to the Department of Home Affairs, and a similar search is conducted against their records to determine whether we can find the fingerprint and identify the person on that system. So that is the process that will be followed. So the memorandum of understanding that will be concluded between the two departments will regulate that relationship and how the stuff will be transferred and how will we receive our responses back. That's in essence. Of course, it will provide for certain protocols to be followed in order to ensure that it actually comes from SAPS and to make sure that there is no breach of security of the system itself.
Then I think I see a nod from state law advisors. They seem to be, I'm not sure if you're satisfied with that response for now. Okay. Then I think that basically brings us to the end of this input from the Department of Home Affairs. So I think I'd like to say thank you very much to the department for appearing before us, for the inputs, for the responses and so on that you've given. I think it has given us some things to think about as well. There's definitely some areas here that have come up that we need to be taking into serious consideration as we move on with the process around the bill. I won't recap them. I think we've made notes of them and we know what they are. But thanks very much to the department. Members, before we close, I know one of the things that we were supposed to have looked at today was the issue of minutes. But I think just talking to Jeremy here, we'll probably look at trying to put them in later, and probably on Monday or on Tuesday. But that pack of minutes that we got is actually not that very big. It's actually minutes with the annexes. So what I would like to urge is those of us who haven't gone through them, if we could please just go through them so that we can pass them. We can't use them until next year. We do need to pass them this year. Just to remind you, tomorrow's meeting starts at 9 o'clock. It's in room F26.
that's in the NCOP wing, starting at 9 o'clock. When I indicated who would be coming tomorrow, I said Department of Police, Department of Transport, CETA, and the chair has also asked for the Department of Justice to be asked if they want to make any input as well, so I omitted to mention that. But members, thank you very much for your contributions. Thank you for helping the meeting to go easy. And we'll see you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Thanks very much.
Excuse me, can I have your business card, please? And can I also have your card, please?
Oh, God, you can have my name on it.
Okay, I know that's fine.